So welcome back to this workshop titled How to Cultivate Mental Balance and Wellbeing. So today, just to recap, we are looking at how we can cultivate a state of well-being by cultivating four types of mental balance. This sort of model or framework we're using today is coming from an article written some years ago by Alan Wallace. And the well-being that we're talking about here, of course, is this state of genuine happiness, a state of inner well-being that is not dependent on any particular stimulus. So we need to distinguish this from what's called temporal happiness or pleasure, a stimulus-based happiness. So when we're talking about well-being here, cultivating well-being, we're talking about cultivating a state of genuine happiness. Of course, this is not saying it's a choice. What we're actually saying is that by cultivating this state of genuine happiness, a side effect of that actually is that you'll probably find that you'll enjoy the simple pleasures in life more than we do now. But this is what we're focusing on. So far, we've looked at motivational balance and attentional balance. And with all of these, we're looking at first how we are now imbalanced in terms of deficit, hyperactivity, meaning not enough, too much, and dysfunctional. And so this is the model we're looking at. And so we're looking at on the basis of first developing a healthy aspiration or desire for happiness, on that basis developing our attention skills, and then on that basis having an attentional balance, going on to develop both cognitive and emotional balance. These are the topics for this afternoon. There is this sort of natural progression here, but as we're going to see later this afternoon, it's not a one-way system, that each of these will have a positive impact on the other. And so if we really want to cultivate well-being, genuine happiness, we need an integrated approach. And if we leave out any one of these four elements, we're going to find it very difficult to develop that state of well-being or genuine happiness. So let's begin this afternoon's topic, which is first we're going to look at cognitive balance. First, of course, how to define cognitive balance. So cognitive balance in this article, it says, is cognitive balance involves engaging with the world of experience without projecting assumptions or ideas which cause us to misapprehend reality. So cognitive balance is about seeing reality as it is. And so the three imbalances here again, deficit, hyperactivity, dysfunctional. Deficit, of course, is failure to perceive what's actually there. So not even seeing what's actually there. Sometimes in Buddhism this is called deprecation, meaning to see things which exist as non-existent because we're not actually able to see what's actually there. And then the other extreme for that is hyperactivity, which is this idea of superimposition, meaning we are projecting things onto reality that don't really exist. So here we're not seeing what's actually there, and here we're projecting on what's actually existing, believing in things which are not existing as existing. And then dysfunctional is really coming from those two imbalances where we end up with a distorted apprehension of reality. And so this is what I'd like to mainly focus on, is this: how we have a distorted apprehension of reality based on either of these two, either deficit or hyperactivity. Now, here, there are a number of ways in which we have a cognitive imbalance in terms of a distorted apprehension of reality. And I'd like to briefly mention four distortions that we have. The first is that we tend to see things as quite stable. Now, of course, we all, at least intellectually, understand that there's no such thing as a stable thing. We all intellectually understand that actually things, everything is changing moment by moment. Science has proven that. We learned it at school. I think none of us have any issue with the fact that everything is changing moment by moment. However, that may be the case intellectually, but experientially, is that how we tend to see things? I think not. You know, for example, this cup here, we know is changing moment by moment, intellectually. But experientially, when we look at that cup, it seems like that's the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. Does that cup exist? Is this cup the same cup that it was yesterday? Will it be the same cup here tomorrow? No. But that's how we relate to that cup. We're seeing it as fairly stable. So this is already a distortion. Another distortion we have is to see things, to see certain experiences in the nature of happiness. And we already looked at this in the context of motivational balance, is that often we see our pleasant experiences as in the nature of happiness. That pleasant experience is in the nature of happiness, so let's try and hold on to that pleasant experience. But as we saw in looking at the First Noble Truth, the idea of dukkha, we can understand that our pleasant experiences are not in the nature of happiness. They're simply relative experiences. And again, intellectually, when we think about that, we can maybe appreciate that our pleasant experiences are relative, and if we overindulge, they'll turn into suffering. So intellectually, again, maybe not that difficult to appreciate. But again, is that how we are seeing things in our daily life? Or, like the cup, are we seeing instinctively pleasant things as in the nature of happiness? So this is another type of distortion we have of reality. A third distortion of reality is the idea of what's called autonomous self, is that we often feel as if somehow there's a me here, a me that seems to be more than simply the body and the mind. There seems to be a third thing here, this me, somewhere in here, and this me seems to be something more than just the body and the mind. It seems to stand apart from the body and the mind a little bit. We have this in our language. We often say, I have a body, I have a mind, as if there's a third thing. There's this me that has a body and has a mind. This me is autonomous. It seems to stand apart. It seems to stand by itself, having some autonomous existence. That is what's called autonomous self. It's this instinctive belief in believing there is this me here, this autonomous self, that's something more than the body and the mind. So that is another distortion. And the fourth is believing that there is an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. So again, it seems like, in fact, there is an independent me and an independent world. That's what it seems like in our experience. Just like it seems like that cup's very stable, and it seems like pleasant experiences are in the nature of happiness, And there really seems to be this autonomous me here. Also, it seems like there is this independent world out there. There's an independent me here and an independent world out there. And the Buddhist assertion is this is another distortion, that this is not how things exist. So now, intellectually, I think we all accept there's no such thing as a stable thing. We know that. Science has proven it. So that's easy to overcome that intellectually. Intellectually, we may also be able to appreciate things are not in the nature of happiness. These two also, maybe, if we think about them, we can come to realize, yeah, there is no autonomous self, there is no independent me, independent world. But maybe these, we don't really have some sort of intellectual appreciation that they don't exist. So what I'd like to do is to have a look at these in a little bit more detail in terms of how to cultivate cognitive balance to overcome this imbalance. Is that sort of clear okay so far?
I don't think I'm really clear of the difference between autonomous self and independent me.
Right. It's a sort of degree of subtlety. Autonomous self would imply independent, but the idea of independent doesn't have to necessarily imply that. But maybe when we come into the explanation, it'll become a little bit more obvious. So maybe I'll leave it till the explanation.
I'm finding it, at least at this stage, difficult to reconcile what you're saying here with the exercises you invited us to do earlier, paying attention to something out there.
In what context? The attentional balance?
You're inviting us to believe that you're suggesting that there's a mistake in the assumption that there's me and the outside world. Are you?
Depends what you mean by outside world.
Well,
there is an outside world.
Right, an independent world.
Ah, that's different from outside.
Okay. The first question then is, would you explain the difference between independent and outside?
By outside, I assume you mean physically outside the body.
Mm-hmm.
That exists. Just because something's outside the body, does that mean that it exists independent of the observer? That's another question. So what I'm talking about here is that our natural assumption that the world exists independently of the observer.
Right.
We're not arguing, is the world physically separate from the observer? That's not right in question.
I've been around Buddhism long enough be able to pay lip service to those propositions.
Well, we shouldn't pay lip service to any proposition.
Yeah, no, I'm describing my own situation, not everybody else's.
Sure.
But some of the exercises, if I understand them correctly, you've asked us to do, effectively, it seems to me, reinforce that gap.
Okay. Right. So I assume you're meaning the exercise being this one.
I can't see. Sorry.
Attentional balance.
Yes.
So in attentional balance, we are the aim of attentional balance is just to develop our attention skills. In this aspect, which is part of a whole framework, we're not questioning this. This part of the training is simply to develop our attention skills. This part of the training or balance is to question our cognitive aspect of experience. How are these things that we're attending to, how do they exist? So these are two aspects of a complete picture. So in attention training, part of that is not to question how are these things we're attending to, like how is the breath or the mental appearances, how do they exist? That's part of the cognitive training. Of course, we need to cultivate them as a whole, as an integrated whole, for sure. But here, we were only interested in developing our ability to see clearly. And this is something that's going to come up later, is attentional balance is about our ability to see clearly. If we don't have that, it's going to be almost impossible to see how these things exist. If you can't see clearly, how are you going to see how they exist? So this is the basis of this. So here we're not asking questions about how do these things exist. That comes here. So here, we're not assuming, we don't need to assume, oh, are they external, internal, are they independent or not? That's actually, in this context, is irrelevant.
Right.
But it's very relevant here, and that's where we are now. That's very relevant. That's the whole purpose here, is are these things that we can actually now see clearly, how do they exist? Let's see that. Let's check that. And that's what cognitive balance is about. Sure.
If we're saying it's irrelevant in the attentional bits, but part of the process by which we develop that attention involves a me. I sit and I focus, and I focus on the breath and I focus on the body. So
right.
It's that me. So I thought I got it until you raised that question, and now I'm confused.
No, but again, and again, in developing attention skills, of course it's me. I'm developing attention skills. You're...
And am I assuming a me that's separate to my...
No, you don't need to assume anything.
Okay.
In attention training...
We could call it anything, apples and pears.
Yeah. So in attention training, we are not interested in how we exist, how does the breath exist. That's a question to ask in this aspect of the practice.
So we're not making assumptions about how we exist.
No, we're not saying in attention training there's an independent me here focusing on independent breath.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we have this imbalance during that training, but that's not really affecting the training in the attention training. It's affecting this, of course.
So cognitive balance. With the cognitive part.
Yeah. So that cognitive imbalance will never be solved through attentional training. Attentional training will mean that we will more clearly be able to see these imbalances. See, this is the thing that was going to come up later, but I'll bring in now very briefly, is that in all of the Buddhist traditions, of course, all these aspects, although we're using a sort of psychological framework, but it maps very well onto Buddhist framework, is that all these aspects are important. But then when you actually look at various Buddhist traditions, what they're focusing on, then a lot of them are focusing on this. And of course, in Buddhism, this is often called vipassana, or vipassana training. You know, vipassana, vipassana. And so they're trying to overcome these distortions, but they haven't really done much attentional training. So then, of course, they can't clearly see this and overcome it. So their vipassana practice or their cognitive balance practice they put a lot of effort in, but don't get anywhere because their attention training, their attention skills are very poor, poorly developed. That's why. That's why we have this written like this, because without attention skills, it's going to be almost impossible to develop cognitive or emotional balance to any significant level. And you're not going to be able to develop attention skills as long as your motivations are all screwed up. You know, as long as you have a lot of craving and attachment for pleasures and so forth, then there's no way you're going to develop any attention skills. But if you develop attention skills, then you can use that in investigating things in cognitive training, and you can use those attention skills in developing better emotional balance. And that's what sort of where we are now in the cognitive balance.
This seems to fit very well with the six perfections.
Well, hopefully it fits well with all sorts of frameworks, because here we talk the three higher trainings, which is the sort of the core framework, but I mean, this is nothing really other than the six perfections. The six perfections is a little bit more elaborate version of this. And of course, this hopefully maps onto this in a good way. So these are just different frameworks, different ways of highlighting the important aspects of the complete picture. That's all. Okay. So these are some of the core dysfunctions that we have in terms of cognitive balance. So let's have a look now at how to cultivate cognitive balance, i.e. how to overcome these imbalances. Generally here, as one of the fundamental or foundation trainings within Buddhism in terms of how to cultivate cognitive balance, we have what's called the four applications of mindfulness. So remember, mindfulness, again here, one of the main tools. Mindfulness is developed in attentional training. So we're cultivating mindfulness in the attention training, in the attentional balance. And then now we're going to apply that mindfulness that we've developed in the attention training. We're going to apply this mindfulness to investigate reality. And in the four applications of mindfulness, we turn our attention to four main things. Is that in our experience, we investigate our own body. We investigate feelings in our mind, and feelings here, again, this is a word we have to be careful about in Buddhism. Feelings is a translation of the Sanskrit word vedana. And normally in English, when we see this word feelings, for us that's sort of synonymous with emotions. But in Buddhism, it doesn't mean emotion. The word feeling in Buddhism, again, is a translation of Sanskrit word vedana. And feeling simply, that mental factor is simply our experience of things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So here we're talking about just investigating those pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experiences. Or that experience of things being pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Then, of course, investigating our own mind, and then all phenomena. And phenomena here, in particular, we're interested in the causal interactions between things. So we are to apply our mindfulness to investigate these areas. The reason that feelings, I think, come separately, because feelings, of course, are within the mind, so you could just lump it in here. But the reason it's comes, I think, separately here, and in many other places, you'll see this word, this feeling as separate, is this is where a lot of our problems begin. Is because, again, one of our distortions is to see things in the nature of happiness, particularly our pleasant experiences. And also, what we're going to see in the next one, when we talk about emotional balance, is that We tend to be stimulus reaction machines. We get pleasant stimulus, I want that attachment. We receive unpleasant stimulus, push it away, aversion. So instinctively, we don't have a clear perception of feelings. Again, we're grasping at pleasant ones, having aversion to unpleasant ones. So that's why often, in many contexts, this gets very much highlighted. So we are to investigate these four objects or areas using mindfulness. What are we to investigate is whether or not we have any of these things that we believe in.
Applications the same as the five skandhas?
Not really. I mean, you could draw some parallels, but yeah. No. So what we are to do with each of these is, for example, to apply mindfulness to the body to see if there's anything stable in the body. Are any of the experiences, physical sensations in the nature of happiness? Is there an autonomous self somewhere here? Is there an independent me somewhere there? So, therefore, we apply those mindfulness in each of these areas to come to see whether or not things are as we believe them to be. So then what we're trying to cultivate in cognitive balance is we're trying to gain four insights into reality, correct insights into reality, instead of these four distortions. We are using mindfulness to investigate body, feelings, mind, phenomena, to come to realize the opposites of these, to realize impermanence, to realize dukkha, what we looked at briefly, to realize no self. So those first three types of cognitive balance are called the three marks of existence. So by applying our mindfulness, investigating the body, the feelings, the mind, and phenomena in general, we can come, using, of course, our attention skills, a calm, clear mind, we can come to see that wherever we look, everything's changing moment by moment. There's not a stable thing to be seen anywhere. So by applying our mindfulness and doing this investigation, we can come to realize impermanence. Now, again, here this word impermanence, like its opposite word permanent, we need to understand correctly. Again, sometimes there's confusion here. Because in Buddhism, often we talk about things being either permanent or impermanent. And often when we use those words in daily life, for us in daily life, permanent often means lasts forever. Impermanent means doesn't last forever. That's not the meaning of the word permanent and impermanent here. Permanent in Buddhism doesn't even ask the question, does this thing last forever or not? The word permanent in Buddhism simply means, is this thing changing from one moment to the next? If it's not, it's permanent. If this thing is changing from one moment to the next, it's impermanent. So in Buddhism, there are things which are permanent that last for a very short time. There are things which are impermanent that last forever. So again, permanent and impermanent in Buddhism is simply saying, is this changing from one moment to the next or not? So by applying our mindfulness to these four areas, investigating these four areas, we can come to see and realize there's nothing stable. Everything in the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena is changing moment by moment. Now, there was a question earlier, and this is where I'd like to tie it in, is don't we already know things are impermanent? But remember here, cognitive balance is not simply having correct intellectual understanding. Because with particularly impermanence, I think at an intellectual level, we have cognitive balance with respect to impermanence. I think we all accept things are changing moment by moment intellectually. But here, when we talk about cognitive balance, we're talking about experiential. Are we experientially seeing things as changing moment by moment? And I think the answer is no. Experientially, it seems as if things are quite stable and unchanging. And that's how we relate to things. And our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits, not our intellectual understanding. So our behavior is driven by our instinctive habit that things are quite stable. And that's how we relate to things. This is out of sync with reality. This is a distortion. And that's why we have mental afflictions and suffering from a Buddhist perspective. So what we need to do to really develop cognitive balance, we need to go through three stages. And here I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short. The three stages are go, nyam, tok. Go, in Tibetan, go means intellectual. So the first stage is to gain a correct intellectual understanding. And with respect to impermanence, I think we already have this. Science has proven it. We learnt it at school. I think for all of us, we already have this with regard to impermanence. Whereas with the idea of independent me, independent world, maybe some of us don't have that yet. So maybe for that, we have to reflect and think about things to come to a correct intellectual understanding the fact that there's no independent me, no independent world. But here, for impermanence, I think we already have that. But again, our behaviour is not driven by this. So what we need to do is to bring this intellectual understanding into experience to really develop cognitive balance. That's the second step, nyam. Nyam means taste or experience. So therefore, as part of cognitive balance training, we apply mindfulness to body, feelings, and mind and phenomena to come to see, is there anything in those areas that is stable? And then we can directly see in body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, everything's changing moment by moment. And then through that, we have some taste or experience of that fact experientially in meditation. This can start to have a strong impact on our mind. So much so that when we come out of that meditation, then maybe for a short time, we are experientially seeing things as more flowing, changing moment by moment. That may last a few seconds, a few minutes, a few hours, maybe a few days. During that time, now we have much better cognitive balance in terms of at least impermanence. We're not distorting at that level, which means we're in harmony with reality. While we're in that state, then it becomes difficult now to react to things. Because now what we do, of course, is something pleasant comes, I want. Unpleasant, push it away. But if we're experientially seeing things as flowing and we receive a pleasant experience, it becomes very difficult to have attachment because actually there's nothing to grab because everything's changing, flowing. So there's no basis or very little basis for attachment to operate. So then if we have a pleasant experience, while we're in this nyam on impermanence, we can simply enjoy it. And there's nothing to attachment. Or if it's unpleasant, there's nothing to push against, aversion. So this experience, if it's still affecting our mind, would mean that in daily life, much less reactive to pleasant, unpleasant things. Enjoy pleasant things more, have less aversion, less magnification of unpleasant things, things go a lot better. But, unfortunately, this experience is not very stable, so it slowly wears off, and then we're back to seeing things as stable. And then we're reacting. Attachment, aversion, difficulties. So what we need to do is we need to bring it to the third step, talk, which is realization. What do we need to do to get from here to here? We need to have a very stable mind. We need to do more work in attentional balance. We need to develop our attention skills much more. We need to develop mindfulness much more. So we need to engage in our attention training to develop a high level of attention skills, a level that I think generally in psychology is seen to be impossible, whereas in Buddhism, completely possible, that we can develop this single-pointed concentration to a very high level. If we can really develop that level of stability and clarity in an attention training, then when we sit down and do these four applications of mindfulness, instead of simply having a little taste or experience of impermanence, we can come to a direct experience of impermanence. That will have a very profound impact on our mind, very stable experience, that will stay with us. Then, outside of meditation, our normal way of seeing things will be things are changing moment by moment. So that's the difference between nyam and tok. So therefore, this is why in the integrated model, if we don't develop these attention skills, cognitive balance training is, at best, maybe it might get you here. It won't, certainly won't get you there. So, therefore, if we want cognitive balance to have some lasting, stable impact and also emotional balance, similarly, we need attention training to a very high level. The more we develop the attention, the more we move from intellectual to taste to realization. Any questions here?
I'm jumping ahead possibly. But
okay.
Is the message what you're saying that I should spend more time on concentration, attention, fiddling about with other things?
That's a very good question. I was hoping someone would ask that. From this presentation, the answer seems to be yes. But what we need to realize is it's not just a one-way street. So therefore, when you put work into cognitive training, that's going to go here, and particularly it'll help here. It will help here. This will help that. That will help that. This will help this. So what you will find, if you take this to the extreme and say, well, okay, then I need to just work here. I'll forget about that now. I won't do anything there. What you'll find is, because you have great imbalances in cognitive, emotional imbalances, that's going to disrupt your attention training practice. You know, getting caught up in attachment, aversion, you know, agitation, cravings, which is this, is going to affect this. So if you do just this, none of this, you're not going to get very far.
I mean, I'm speaking for myself.
Sure.
I think I tend to treat, I mean, I don't think I've ever thought of this before, but this afternoon, I think I treat attentional training as not very glamorous, not very, yes, you know, it's not core to Buddhism.
Well, actually, there's no Buddhist tradition that says that.
I appreciate that.
It's true.
It's a bit unglamorous. It's a bit...
Well, it's not sexy.
Yes.
Exactly. And all Buddhist traditions say this is the... Which is another way of putting this. But as I briefly mentioned this morning, if you look in the different traditions, how many of Buddhist traditions are emphasizing this? You go into the Theravada traditions, Vipassana, which is this. Or this, it's another word for this. Tibetan tradition, deity yoga, bodhicitta, emptiness. This.
Yes, that's really what I'm getting at.
This and this. And that's right. But what I'm suggesting here today is that there is a flow here and there is a holistic notion. So... We need to engage in all four areas in a balanced way, but understanding, and as a beginner, if our motivations are completely whacked, which often people come into spiritual practice, motivation here is what's called the eight worldly concerns, you know, and so then they use the spiritual path, trying to do particularly these things with a wrong motivation, and then it's just a mess. Similarly, then, you know, they come in and what's often happening now, of course, is this is getting a lot of attention outside of Buddhism, you know, the whole idea of the mindfulness, because finally, outside of Buddhism and in Buddhism, it's seeing now, oh geez, actually, maybe we need to do something here, because if we don't, maybe this doesn't really work. So actually, I've seen now in a lot of traditions, there seems to be more emphasis on this because just doing this or this is not going to get you very far. I mean, you can spend years doing your sadhana, doing your bodhicitta motivation, doing this and that, but if your mind is all dull and distracted, you're not even, forget about realization, you're not even going to get here. You know, because we're always talking about, we have to realize bodhicitta, we have to realize emptiness. I mean, how are you going to do that without any attention skills? I mean, it's impossible. Impossible. So we need to make sure that we understand this and work appropriately. But what we're not saying is, I need to go off for 3 years and do a retreat to develop single point of concentration. Then I'll start to do my bodhicitta and emptiness practice. This will not work either. Because while we're developing attention skills, we need to work a little bit here to sort of subdue our dysfunctional mind in both of these areas a little bit so that we can have some space to work on here. Because if we don't, these imbalances here are going to block us from actually developing this. So we need a balance, an integrated approach. Now, unfortunately, what happens is, like I said just now, this idea of this attention training now actually, fortunately, in many Buddhist traditions, is getting more spotlight. We need to really do this, and often in Buddhism it's called like shamatha practice. So through people like Alan Wallace and others, even Lama Zopa is now, and His Holiness Dalai Lama is also now in the last years talking a lot more about the big requirement to do shamatha practice. So now it's really starting to get more screen time, which is a good thing. But now also outside of Buddhism, it's now seen, attention training, that could be a good idea for corporate world and stuff. But what's often happening is, that mindfulness is very good. But all this other stuff, that's religious stuff. Let's get rid of that. Let's just take out that mindfulness. That's the solution to everything. Let's just work on mindfulness and that'll solve all your problems. It won't work. It won't work. In fact, what will happen, particularly because this, for many of us, is screwed up, we'll just be more mindful in our dysfunctional behaviour. True. We'll be more mindfully trying to make more money, be more greedy, because there's no good motivation. And cognitive and emotional balance is gone. So there's a very nice term that for this sort of... So I'm not saying that all modern-day mindfulness movements are in that boat, but there's quite a number that, for whatever reason, maybe they can make money or... They just want to think that one thing is going to solve everything. I don't know what the thinking is, but they just strip it out and then they go all this other stuff. Oh, no, ethics? Oh, no, that's that religious stuff. You know, and all this, oh, that's religious. No, throw it out. Throw it out. And so they end up with bare mindfulness. But again, without context, it doesn't really work. And it's a nice term someone coined called mook mindfulness. Mook mindfulness. Like fast food mindfulness. I mean, like fast food, not healthy, same mook mindfulness, not very healthy. In fact, it can lead us to be, if particularly if we have very poor motivations in our life, it can just lead us to be more focused on how to manipulate people better to make more money and be more greedy. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a disaster. So does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, where were we? Right, so impermanence. So I think I don't need to mention too much more about impermanence because that's something we already have at least the intellectual level. We just really need to internalise that to come to experience and realise. To talk about the other three elements before we have another tea break, the second one was, remember the imbalance was to... see our experiences in the nature of happiness. So the cognitive training here is to come to taste and experience or realize what's called dukkha. We already looked at that briefly earlier. As the word used by the Buddha to describe the human condition. You know, that sometimes we have unpleasant experiences, sometimes we have pleasant experiences, but underlying both of those, we have the simple fact that we have the all-pervasive dukkha that, you know, that there's always a potential for some sort of suffering to arise. So by applying our mindfulness in these four areas, we can come to realize this unsatisfactory state that we find ourselves in. If we can really come to taste and experience this and realize dukkha, then of course that's going to have a profound impact on our life, because by realizing dukkha, that will actually sort out our motivation a lot. Because by realizing dukkha in this cognitive balance training, we're going to realize there's no happiness to be found out there. The source of happiness and suffering was within our own mind. And by realizing this dukkha, we will actually develop this motivation of renunciation, this motivation for liberation from suffering, from samsara. So by this cognitive balance training here, of course, is going to feed back and improve our motivation. And then on the other side here, which we're looking at later, the emotional balance training, part of that then also is to improve our attitude towards others. And so that's also going to feed back into the motivational balance by building on that aspiration for liberation to what's called the aspiration of bodhicitta. So that will particularly help to improve motivation to that level. So you can begin to see a little bit how each one is part of a whole, and we need all of those four aspects. So that's the second one. The third one, remember the distortion was seeing an autonomous self here. That's the distortion. What we want to realize here, of course, is no self. So the three marks of existence are three things we're trying to come to realize about existence. Everything's changing moment by moment. We are in this state of dukkha, unsatisfactory state, and there is no self. So just a few words on this. So here we mean no autonomous me. So intellectually, we may appreciate me is simply something we're labeling on the basis of the body and the mind that is here. But I think experientially, when we have a sense of me, we tend to have this sense that this me seems very solid and very autonomous. It seems to really exist on its own. It seems not to depend upon anything else to exist. And it seems to be something more than just the body and the mind. There's a body, there's a mind, and then there's this third thing. There's a me here. And this me, and we have that in our language, this me, I have a body. I have a mind. As if there's another thing, there's a third thing, a me that has a body and has a mind. I think that's how we experientially see ourselves. That, from a Buddhist perspective, is a false sense of me. It's a distortion. So that's a belief in an autonomous me. And the way to overcome that, of course, is, again, applying mindfulness to investigate within our body, feelings, and mind, where is this autonomous me here that seems to be here? And what we can come to see by applying mindfulness to our body and mind, looking directly, we'll come to see there's nothing here that is a me. Nothing to be found. And we can realize, therefore, there's no autonomous me. There's no self. What we're saying, of course, we're not saying there's no me. We're saying we will not, if you do that application of mindfulness, there is nothing here that is an autonomous self. You will not find that. But we need to apply mindfulness to search here for that. Any questions on this?
Sorry, I still don't understand.
Sure.
I can't understand.
Right. What in particular don't you understand?
There's no me.
No. There is no Buddhist tradition that says there's no me. No Buddhist tradition says this. There is a me. There is a me, there's a you, there's a cup, there's flowers, there's a world. No Buddhist tradition says none of these exist. This is nihilism. What we are trying to do in our cognitive training is not looking at do I exist or not. We do exist. Just like the cup exists, flowers exist, world exists. Cognitive training, we're applying our mindfulness to see how do I exist? How does the cup exist? How does the flowers exist? How does the world exist? So this training here is to come to realize me, who does exist, is not an autonomous me. We're not an autonomous self. That's not how we exist. Because if we search, we believe, experientially, we tend to believe there is an autonomous me here, that the me is something more than the body and the mind. I think we have that. Because in our language, we say, I have a body, I have a mind, as if the me is a third thing, another thing that has a body and has a mind. That's how we speak. I think that's how we think of ourselves. But if we apply mindfulness and we look for this me that seems to be more than the body and the mind, will we find such a me? And if we don't find such a me, that implies there's no autonomous me. It does not imply there's no me. So that's what the realization here is to come to realize we, who do exist, are not existing as an autonomous self. That's the realization here. That's often the difficulty, because often when people see this, they say, oh, according to Buddhism, there's no me. That's not the case.
Is it like part of a bigger collection?
No.
At least I bought. Maybe I'm referring to those.
Yeah. So that's right. So what we need to realize, and then I think to help answer that, I want to briefly now for the next 10 minutes or so before we take another break, is look at the third point. I think that's going to help. So they're the three marks of existence. So by applying mindfulness, we can come to realize each of those, which will help us to overcome the distortions of seeing stable things, things in the nature of happiness, and autonomous self. Then the other insight, by applying mindfulness, we can come to the fourth insight, is the insight into emptiness. And so this is, by using mindfulness, we can investigate and see, is there an independent me here and an independent world there? Because that's what we sort of believe in now. So by investigating me, the person, and the world, we can come to see there's no independent me, no independent objective world. So emptiness, again, like this word no self, doesn't mean there's no me and no world. It simply means there's no independent me, no independent world. So emptiness is simply saying that everything is empty of existing independently. That's what emptiness means. It doesn't mean nothing really exists. So therefore, emptiness is saying nothing exists independently. Why? Because everything exists dependently. So if we can appreciate what it means for things to exist dependently, we can better understand emptiness. So how do things exist dependently? We can talk about dependency in three ways. Things exist depending on causes and conditions. This laptop, for it to exist, depends on causes and conditions. It needed originally someone to think about designing it. It needed all the raw materials, needed all those materials to be refined, all the various components needed to be manufactured, all those components needed to be assembled. And of course, all the people and factories and everything else in that process were necessary. So all of those causes and conditions were necessary for us to have a laptop here. So this laptop, its very existence, depends on all of those causes and conditions. Without that, there would be no laptop here now. Fairly straightforward. There's another way in which things exist dependently. And that is, things depend on their paths. So in Buddhism, when we say things exist dependently, the word often used is dependent arising. Arising here means coming into existence. So things come into existence dependently in three ways. The first one we've already looked at. The second way in which things exist dependently is they depend on their parts. So again, this laptop exists depending on its parts. Without the frame, without the screen, without the buttons, the electronic components, without all these parts, there would be no laptop. So the laptop exists depending on all of its parts. Again, fairly straightforward. But what we're saying here is that the idea that things exist dependently should be overturning our distortion that things exist independently. But I think we're all pretty happy to accept that this laptop exists depending on causes and conditions and exists depending on its parts. But at the same time, we're probably happy to except that this laptop is already existing here on the table when we walk in the door. True? I think so. But actually, with this logic, that shouldn't be possible. Because if things are dependent, they can't be independent. So if things exist dependently, there cannot be an independent laptop here sitting on the table when we walk in the door. But this doesn't seem to, they don't seem to be contradictory. Why? It's because we don't really appreciate this at the deepest level. We only understand them fairly superficially. To understand these at a deeper level, we have to go to the third way in which things are dependent. And the third way in which things are dependent is that things depend on labelling, conception. Another word sometimes used here is designation, imputation, many different terms. They all mean the same thing. What does it mean for things to exist depending on labelling or conception? So again, we might think, oh, I know what that means. There's a thing here on the table. I'm calling this a laptop. Again, fairly superficial understanding. How are we to understand this at a deeper level? When we look out on the world around us, what we receive is a mass of sense data, particularly visual data. And we have to make sense or meaning out of all of this data. Otherwise, we couldn't function. Nothing would have meaning. So what we do with all this data is to make sense or meaning out of it, we draw lines around various collections of data and we create objects. So we divide up all of this stuff into objects. We create objects with our mind. But then, of course, we need to be able to communicate with others. So we have to do more than draw these lines. We have to give names to the objects that we've created so that we can communicate with others. We have to do this, otherwise we couldn't function. So what we really do is we draw lines and then give a name. Already when you've drawn a line and created an object, you've already done this. Giving a name is like icing on the cake. So this is what labeling or conception means. It means we create a world of objects through drawing lines, giving names. Which means, and how we do that is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary depending on the meaning that we want from the world. So it depends on the context and the meaning. So the way of drawing lines is completely arbitrary. For example, how many objects are there? How many?
One. I'm just going to start the order.
So, yes, there could be one star, but also we could say there's two triangles there. We could say there's six triangles there. Or we could say there's six triangles and a hexagon. Or we could say there's a collection of 18 lines. So is there 1, 2, 6, 7, or 18 objects there? How many objects are there? We decide. So there's not a star there existing from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. Our conceptual framework creates the star, which means there's no star findable here, because we create the star. So often then, here, we see a couple of terms when we talk about this. One is that things are merely labelled. That's a very common term, meaning they only exist, merely meaning only, of course, they only exist within our conceptual framework. Nothing more than that. And another word you'll see is things are not findable. Meaning you won't find a star there from its own side independent of our conceptual framework. So there's no star waiting there for us to experience it. We create the star through drawing one line and giving a name. So this is what we mean by things being labeled or depending on labeling or conception. Now, of course, we have to do this labeling. We have to draw these lines and give names. Otherwise, we couldn't function. And I think a newborn baby can't even do that. The problem is, of course, and intellectually, we may appreciate this. So intellectually, we may be able to understand, yes, things are merely labeled. Things exist through labeling and conception. Okay, I can appreciate that. But again, is that how we're experientially seeing the world? No. Experientially, it seems like the world is already divided up into many separate, discrete things. So actually, our experience is out of sync with reality. And that's why we have mental afflictions and suffering. Because experientially, we're believing, actually, there is an independent me here and an independent world there. In fact, very often in our experience, the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here, and we conceptually create experiencer, because there's single experience. In experience, there are two aspects, experiencer, experienced. We need to draw the line and distinguish experiencer and experienced. Otherwise, we couldn't make sense or meaning. But again, the problem is we don't realize that's what we're doing. We believe that there's already an independent me here and an independent world of experience. So we've turned our line into a boundary, two independent things. But that's called self-grasping. By grasping onto this me that we've created and believing it's an independent me, this is grasping to self, independent me, self-grasping. But that actually is completely illogical. And to highlight that, I can ask a question. Is this big? Is it big?
Depends what you compare it to.
So you can't have big and small. Easy, yeah? I mean, big, saying this is big is just illogical.
Compared to, yes, yeah.
So they're relative, they're dependent.
Yeah. Yeah.
So big can only exist depending on small. Yeah. Likewise, up can only exist depending on down, in to out. Like that, you can only have me if you have not me. What you label the not me, world, you, doesn't matter. You can only have experiencer if you have experienced. You can only have subject if there's object. But what we do, of course, is we grasp onto the me part of the experience and we believe, actually, there's an independent me here, independent of the experienced. That self-grasping, believing in independent me, is exactly like saying, this is big. It just does not make any sense whatsoever. But that's what we instinctively believe in and grasp to. And from a Buddhist perspective there, we are completely out of sync with reality. And if we're out of sync with reality, we're fighting against reality. If we fight against reality, we get mental afflictions, we suffer, people around us suffer. So, and then we need to go for a break. I could talk about this all day, of course, but we've only got so many of time. I've lost what I was going to say now. There's so many things to say, but I wanted to just say one thing. Sometimes, and often in our behavior, we have this self-grasping very strong. Because often we have this perspective of me going there, me saying this, me doing that. It's always me, 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 me. With this grasping, oh, yes, there is, of course, an independent me here. So often our self-grasping is very strong, and that's why we often have a lot of mental afflictions, attachment, aversion, and problems. But sometimes in our behavior, the self-grasping is not so strong. And that often happens when we are more focused on the activity rather than the me doing the activity. For example, when we're absorbed in a good book, absorbed in a good program on TV, absorbed in fixing a problem at work. On those occasions, we're more focused on the action, the activity, than the agent. So often then, the self-grasping is very much reduced. And often then, when we're in that state, we often, things seem to go a lot better. Time seems to go quite quickly. Why? Because we're not as out of sync with reality. We're not fighting against so much because self-grasping is not so strong. And this is very much emphasized in people who've developed high level of focus in their activities. For example, professional musicians, professional athletes who've spent thousands of hours training in their activity have developed a high level of focus. So much so that when they engage in their activity, they often report they get into the zone or the flow state. And in that state, they often say, you know, there's no sense of me. There was just the music playing, just the activity happening. And not only that, they often report peak performance, optimum performance in that state. Why? Because of the focus, the self-grasping is very much reduced. And therefore, we're not fighting against reality so much. Of course, this is only through the power of concentration that self-grasping is reduced. Here in cognitive training is we're talking about, through our application of mindfulness, investigating body, mind, person, world, we'll come to realize there is no independent me, no independent world. And by realizing that, we can overcome that cognitive imbalance, which means then we can experientially see that there is only a dependent me in a dependent world. We'll be completely in harmony with the world, and from a Buddhist perspective, then there's no basis for any mental afflictions or suffering to arise, and we can overcome that. So that was very briefly some cognitive training. Any very last question before we take a break? Let's take a tea break, 20 minutes, then we'll come back and look at emotional balance and then wrap up a little bit on integration.